Good afternoon. I will call the House Higher Education Finance and Policy meeting to order. We don't quite have a quorum just yet, so we've got some members that are going to be coming in. So we're going to move ahead in the agenda and welcome the welcome Mayo Clinic. I almost said the Mayo. We just had an offline conversation about the proper name. So welcome Mayo Clinic here today. And I'm going to just turn it over to you. State your name for the record, and please start off with your slide presentation.
Thank you for having us today. My name is Dave Dolan. I'm the Education Compliance Officer and the Accreditation Liaison for the Mayo Clinic. And if technology works the way we hope, I think my colleague John Poe is on the Zoom link.
Thank you, Dave. Yes, I'm here. Hopefully everyone can hear me. I can see clearly the attendees. Madam Chair, thank you so much for the invitation. We are very pleased to be here today to speak to the committee. It's always a wonderful opportunity to kind of share who we are, what we do, and today also explain how we take the state appropriations and spend that money wisely in our educational efforts. Excuse me. We have a handful of slides. I think we'll start with these. Dave, if you don't mind pulling that up and let me know when the committee members can see it. It looks like it's on screen now. Let's go ahead and advance to the next slide. So the slides are here to just provoke some thought and ideally some conversation with follow-up questions. We're not going to spend a lot of time on them, recognizing that the conversation is more important to us. This first slide really describes the College of Medicine, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science, and how we're structured. The map gives you a sense. We have three large destination medical centers that actually hold campuses for our college. And the college is made up of five schools. I'll start from left to right. The graduate school, which is our PhD, MD, PhD, and PhD, has eight tracks that we offer PhD degrees. We have about 355 students in that school. Following through the School of Graduate Medical Education, we have 305 different training programs between residency and fellowships that we offer. This is really our largest school, frankly. We have 1,782 trainees in the school. This is the largest sponsoring institution across the country, North America, from the standpoint of the number of offerings that we provide. We're not the largest in the sense of number of residents, but the largest number of offerings. If I jump down to the School of Health Sciences, which is your bottom left, we have 150 different programs we offer there. This is truly our allied health. There's a little over 1,700 students in this school. This is truly our entry level to a lot of our workforce. So a wonderful front door from the standpoint of our non-physician, non-scientists. And we offer degrees in here ranging from, CRNAs, or a registered nurse anesthetist, to pharmacist, to phlebotomy. So our programs can span from weeks to years in that school. If I follow through, the next one is our Alex School of Medicine. This is listed as one medical school, but we have three separate campuses. Our primary campus is here in Rochester. That's the creation of the medical school. Next is Arizona, and they too offer a four-year program. And then in Florida, we offer what we call a 2+2 medical school. What does that mean? That means that the first 2 years, the didactic portion of their training actually happens on Rochester or Arizona's campus, and then they go to Florida for their last 2 years for their clinical experiences. The last school that I'm going to speak to regarding the five-school makeup of the college is the Continuous Professional Development. This is where we offer over 535 different events globally. We have well over 100,000 registrations. This is our global reach school from the standpoint of offering certified medical education. Above that, we list our academic nursing partnerships. We feel it's critical to understand that Mayo Clinic structure cannot do higher ed or clinical ed alone. And specifically for the nursing discipline, we have over 42 academic affiliations where we participate in educating over 4,000 nurses annually. So you can see that we have a pretty good reach in relation to the education that we provide. both on the scientific and on the clinical ed perspective. All of this makes up, absent the academic affiliation, our student and learner population is well over 6,000 learners. Next slide, please. This slide just represents for you, we truly are a three-shield organization. Each of those schools really support the three shields. I mentioned the graduate school supports research. For clinical ed, graduate medical education, health sciences, and the medical school support the practice. We do team-based care at Mayo Clinic. We also do team-based learning and education. Every one of our students has an opportunity to not only do practice, but in get involved in research. We have active research projects that not only are the graduate students participating in, but our residents, our fellows, and our medical students are too. Next slide, please. This slide kind of gives you a sense. On the left-hand side is a historical investment that we've realized is probably a challenge for all educational institutions. We're focused on our faculty for our FTEs. Our clinicians are actually our faculty. Our scientists are our faculty. We are always investing in resources, specifically in the wellness for students and student services. We have the challenge of meeting many accreditation requirements, and Dave Dolan can speak to that in depth if there's questions. But on the right-hand side, you see some of the most recent investments that we're putting forward in our educational efforts. AI. So we've started a platform where we've invested in providing AI to them, all 82,000 employees at Mayo Clinic. And the College of Medicine's running that as a primary investor or builder in regards to this. Platform. What do I mean by platform? We recognize that education, we create all these educational assets, digital assets, videos, learning opportunities, learning experiences, and we want to put them on a platform and share that platform through other venues so that we can take education beyond the four walls of a classroom. Regenerative medicine and genomics, we're investing in them heavily on our research side with our graduate school in those eight tracks. We're focusing on automation. We've built in, we have three simulation sites at three different DMCs, but we're also building out some simulation capabilities here in Rochester specifically. And I'll speak to that a little bit more in another slide here. Robotics continues to be an investment. Digital health, there's a slide where we'll talk about how health now, providing health, is actually becoming more and more digital based. And what are we doing about that? We're focusing on innovation and, frankly, leadership. Next slide, please. So I mentioned digital health and education. As you can tell, as healthcare becomes more and more remote, things like remote device technology, remote medical treatment, ICU management, intervention, and robotic surgery. So the way that we've taught clinical education is no longer going to be the way that we teach going forward. I was just reading an article this morning, robotics with the Da Vinci machine has actually been introduced to the clinical practice for 25 years, and it's still exploding from the standpoint of how robotics is impacting clinical care. Well, we need to teach that. That's part of our curriculum development. Next slide. So this is the last slide in regards to kind of where we're going. This one is a representation of our immersive simulation. Most recently, we worked with a benefactor, and we are going to be building a immersive experiential studio here in Rochester that allows us to build out twinning capabilities. If you look at our clinical education specifically, a high percentage, 80%+ of our clinical education is driven by an apprenticeship-like model. So we teach people how to provide care like we provide care on an individual basis. We define competency based on number of opportunities they have. And as an example, my executive dean that partners with me is a neurosurgeon, and he can see two residents every time he goes in an OR room. They have to have an experience of 600 cases before they're deemed competent. This immersive experiential studio will allow us to create these learning experiences at scale provide them experiences more or less on a 24/7 opportunity. It accelerates this. In addition, we're taking this type of capability and we're bringing it to our allied health trade. One small example is our rad techs, radiology technicians. In our programs today, they have to learn how to work with like 10 different devices. Those 10 different devices are across the campuses in different locations. By default of that, logistically, that program is like 10 weeks long. With this capability, we can carve out 3 weeks of that training and provide those learning experiences with those devices, like I mentioned, real time, 24/7. So we're trying to accelerate these programs and create those competencies in a much quicker fashion. I think next we're going to turn this over to Dave, and he's going to go in a little bit more of that detail of how the appropriations in current state are being spent today. So Dave, if you don't mind.
Thanks, John. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks again for having us here. The slide that you see on the screen right now is specific to the appropriation for the medical school, which for the biennium is $1.3 million, $1,330,000. Those funds are used specifically for medical school scholarships for residents of the state of Minnesota who are enrolled in Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. So those funds are direct pass-through. We actually credit those funds on a student's account, so they'll actually see where those funds are coming from, and they are passed right through. The chart actually documents academic year, so you can see how we have been spending the annual amount of $665,000 breaks down to about 40 for the last completed school year, about $41,563 per student. The legislative language specifically says that the program is to encourage and to propagate family medicine primary care physicians in Minnesota. And so I'm pleased to report that of the 12 graduates, so again, the numbers are small, the 12 graduates that we've had over the past 3 years, eight of them have entered into primary care careers, things like family medicine, pediatrics, internal medicine, etc. Four of those are enrolled in residencies in the state of Minnesota, not all at Mayo Clinic, but also four of them went on to do primary care residencies outside of the state of Minnesota. And then that leaves four that went into things like plastic surgery and dermatology, etc. The next slide actually talks about the state capitation for the family medicine residency program, and there are actually two locations. Long-term program has been in Rochester, goes back all the way to 1978 when the program started, and then 3 years ago, forgive me, we, Mayo Clinic, became the sponsoring institution for the family residency program in Mankato. That was prior to it was the University of Minnesota, and so they safely handed that off to the Mayo Clinic. You can see the total biennial appropriation is $2,268,000, breaks down to $1,134,000 per year, and those funds are used to simply assist with paying the expenses of running the program. Things like, remember, residents are employees, so things like salary, benefits, those types of things. And so the Rochester program, going back to 1979, has graduated 321 graduates, and of those, 140 of those are still practicing in primary care family medicine in the state of Minnesota, so 44%. The Mankato program, we became, a participant just a few years ago, 14 graduates, and those are, again, pleased to report that 10 of those graduates are practicing in non-metro counties in the state of Minnesota. So places like Battle Lake, Minnesota, up by Fergus Falls, places like Mankato and Waseca and Fairmont. Three are indeed practicing in Minnesota, but in the metro area, and then one left the state of Minnesota. So with that, I would entertain questions. I'd again say thank you for having us. And I will hit this button and hopefully we can see John again.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan. So I just have a quick question. As you were doing the presentation on the last slide, you had said that the appropriation to the medical school of graduate medical education, the family medicine residency program, is paying for the program as opposed to paying for the students. But I believe you had said that, I was going to say, so you have 42 residents that received the money. I'm confused because you said it paid for the program, but then you've got in the slide that it's directed to residents. Can you explain
that? Yeah, so there are two pieces, the medical school piece and then the family medicine residency program. Family medicine residents are employees, so we don't bill them. We actually pay them a salary per year. And so those dollars are used to assist with the salaries that they're pulling. And John would be able to give me a better number, but first year, what we call a PGY1, postgraduate year one resident. It's been a while since I knew the exact number, but I'm not going to be totally wrong if I say it's around $61,000 a year. So it doesn't, plus there's benefits, they get insurance through Mayo Clinic and Social Security payments, all that stuff.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And members, there is something else in your packet too. So just to get a concept as to how big Mayo Foundation for Medical Education and Research, i.e. Mayo Clinic, interchangeable, how big they are, their gross revenue, their expenses, their assets, because they are technically a nonprofit, although they are a different nonprofit than you would typically think of. So this is in your packets, and it's the Mayo Foundation for Medical Education and Research, and it talks about total revenue. And the most recent data that I've got is $1.18 billion total revenue, $1.14 billion of total expenses. And I believe you did say you had 82 or 84,000 employees.
Something like that, correct.
I'll look again. 82,000 employees. So in lieu of them giving us 150 or more pages of 990, I just gave you some top-level information about Mayo because they are technically a nonprofit, and we are trying to do our due diligence here at the legislature in looking at 990s and audited financial reports. So, yes, Representative Cleburne.
So I just want to be really clear about the word that you're using, nonprofit. It's merely a tax definition. Mm-hmm. So you are either a nonprofit or you are not a nonprofit, right? So to say technically, I feel like you're trying to split Mayo from other nonprofits. It just means that we have given them a tax status because they do some public good. That's all nonprofit means. So I don't want us to just kind of go technically, not technically. You either are or you aren't, right? It's just a tax status. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. I wasn't trying I was just saying that the health systems, many of our health systems are nonprofit. That's their tax status. And in totality here at the legislature, starting in 23, the legislature was trying very hard to have a deeper look. In fact, I wish Representative Knorr was here because he's probably the prime example in his committee. As I found out through the Fraud Prevention Committee, we're trying to have a little more close look at all of the nonprofits that come and we do a direct appropriation to a nonprofit. They're health system, so yes, they're a nonprofit, but in my view, they're a little different than, say, Lutheran Social Services, which is also very big, but they're not a health system. They also do services compared to who we're going to see in a few minutes. Let me finish my thought. When we have Cook County, higher ed, which is a nonprofit, and they're very, very tiny. So I also looked at all of their 990s, their financial reports, their audited financials, to make sure that they were registered with the state AG and Secretary of State. And so all of these compliance things that we do. I'm saying that because this is Mayo, I didn't give you 150-page 990 to review. You will have a packet from Cook County Higher Ed, you will have a 990 and an audited financial report in your packet. So I'm just trying to differentiate a little bit and give some deference to Mayo because they are Mayo. I don't know if that makes any sense. Representative Cleburne?
But that's exactly the point, right? That is exactly the point that I'm trying to make. If we are looking at nonprofits as a whole, we look at nonprofits as a whole, right? Mayo Clinic, while it has an excellent reputation, and I do not want to disparage them in any way, what I'm saying is we, at the legislature, what I'm hearing this year is that nonprofits are bad or that we have to scrutinize every nonprofit. We're trying to paint everything with a very broad brush because there have been some bad actors who were actually for profit, but parsing out which nonprofits we think are good, which nonprofits we think are bad, and really we should be following whatever data we have. It's the data that we need to be scrutinizing and making sure that whoever has a nonprofit status is following the law, following the governance, following the protocols that we set forward. That's all I'm saying. So I just want to make that clear.
Representative Cleburne, thank you. We're trying our best to do that, which I just didn't want to give you 150-page 990 for Mayo. So in lieu of that, I did give you some high-level, also from a compliance website, just about the revenue expenses, their assets, and what they pay. Their top looks like probably, well, it's their probably 25 or so folks. The executives on file, I guess is what it's called. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have some questions for the presenter, but I do want to just note that the document that you gave us is out of date. I'm sure you know that, but John Noseworthy is not the CEO anymore and hasn't been for quite a while, I think. And, you know, I'm sure other people on here are probably no longer there and so on. So I just wanted to point that out. But anyway, my question didn't have to do with that. My question for the presenter, I had a couple of questions, if you'll indulge me, Madam Chair. So on the piece for the graduate school, the residencies that you were talking about, so this is I think funding for residencies is it's a whole many days topic by itself and very complicated. And I think a lot of legislators think that funding for residencies all comes from the federal government. And of course, that's not accurate. So I just wonder if you could tell us kind of what would happen if you didn't have this assistance. I see on your slide that you have about a little over 12% as the percent of the total that's from Minnesota, if I'm understanding what this means. That so you've got, what, 88% coming from other sources. So, but, it, you know, if Mayo didn't get this assistance from the state, which my understanding, residencies are very expensive, and obviously this is a huge workforce issue for the state. So I wonder, could you just fill in that for us a little bit, if you would.
Mr. Dahlin.
Appreciate the question, Madam Chair. I think John Poe would be probably better because he's got a long runway of working in the Mayo Clinic Graduate School of Medical Education before his current role. So, John, would you like to take that?
Mr. Poe.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. And Representative, thank you so much for the question. And I apologize for not being in the room. Unfortunately, I couldn't make the calendar work for today. Should the funding come in question, like we do with any of our funding questions related to our residency and fellowship programs, we would have to look at the size of the program and the contributions to the outcomes. We really are committed to the workforce of the future. Obviously, the workforce of the future for Mayo Clinic is critical, but also the workforce of the future for the state of Minnesota. So if the funding is changed, like we would do with any funding questions, we would have to do the assessment of what changes to the program would we might need to consider. So to be blunt, we'd have to look at the programming again and say, is this still generating the outcomes that we're committed to?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that answer. And then my other question was on your other slide with the scholarship program. And I'm just wondering, so I wasn't aware until really recently about, of this scholarship program, but How does this show up for the student? Do they get a statement that says Minnesota is giving you X amount of scholarship? Is that how this looks from that side?
Appreciate the question.
Mr. Dolan.
Appreciate the question. That's exactly what happens. So we, twice a year in July and January, we bill our students the set tuition amount through the year. We lock tuition when students start, and then there's a, just like any other college invoice, there's a series of credits, and it's absolutely documented as state capitation on their student invoice.
Representative Liebling.
And then, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if you said this either. Is it, it's only Minnesota residents who are eligible for this funding?
Mr. Dolan?
Correct. Yep. And that's in statute. So capitation for Minnesota residents. So we don't provide any of these dollars to anyone who is not a resident of the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hicks?
Thank you so much for coming. I am just going to take a minute to brag about our community. And for those of you that are maybe new to the legislature and to higher ed, this is a tiny part of Mayo's bigger impact on our state. They are the largest private employer in the state of Minnesota and are currently in the process of the largest private investment ever by any corporation or any entity in the state. And so I just want to thank them for coming and for sharing this piece, but also for being part of our robust state economy, where they employ over 51,000 Minnesotans, many in your districts as well, not just in Rochester. So this is just me bragging on my town.
Representative Hicks, I knew you would have something to say today. It is good to have pride. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank you for being here today and testifying. It's, I think, what Mayo has been able to do since the inception of the Mayo brothers and their father moving the area and doing what they did has been has made us basically the shining star of healthcare in the United States. But it brings me to my question. I found an interesting read. It was from Twin Cities Business, February 28th, 2024. Headline, Mayo Clinic net income surpasses $1 billion in 2023. And the actual number is $1.084 billion. Total revenue in the article said was $18 billion in 2023. In 2026 or 2022, it was $16 billion. Revenue contracts in 2023 was $703 million. And in 2022, it was $666 million. It goes on to say the healthcare system revenue increased by every measure last year. As we are digging through the budget and digging through what we have for in terms of available dollars, to be able to help with the higher education system we have here in the state of Minnesota. I'm not discounting what you guys do, the research that you produce, the amount of patents that are generated every year. But it's hard to take into consideration what you're asking the Minnesota taxpayer to fund or kick in back against how much money you guys made last year and year over year for year. It's like everything. We ask our friends, we love you, but sometimes we need you to kick in a little bit on this. Tell me, you know, why should the taxpayer do this?
Mr. Dolan.
Thank you. And I'm going to defer to my boss, John Poe.
Mr. Poe.
He's on mute.
Mr. Poe, you might need to unmute.
Madam Chair, thank you again. Representative, truly appreciate the question. I can assure you from the lens of education, education is not a profit venture. The institution, Mayo Clinic, does provide a base budget to invest in education to ensure that we can provide the workforce of the future. As you can see in the document, it's well over the appropriation amount, the expense and the investment that Mayo Clinic provides to these two programs, the medical school and the family medicine. It's a continual challenge for us. As the practice grows, the need for workforce grows. So we're consistently investing in that. I think I would say from the standpoint of how the actual profit is shared and then reinvested for the institution, I'm not the appropriate party to speak to that. But I feel like we could come back with some high points for you to ensure that the money that is being appropriated is going to the greater need and good cause as intended. And I'd stop at that.
Representative Allen.
I appreciate that, and thank you for your thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that that response. It would be great to have a little bit more context to some of the questions that I had. It's just we have a lot of constituents asking on a regular basis with the amount of clinics Mayo has had in the communities, such as Kenyon, that got shut down. And we look across all of greater Minnesota, and we've seen several of those clinics closing, and it just brings a lot of concern from a lot of us. So it'd be nice to have those numbers if you could please supply that. And thank you.
Any other member questions? Oh, and I will say I'm sorry that I grabbed the wrong document off the internet. So my apologies, I grabbed an outdated document. But maybe, Mr. Allen, if you would just let us know, what is your gross revenue at Mayo, like, say, last year? Since I didn't print out your 990, so I don't have it in front of me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the question. That is a number that I would need to consult with folks back at Mayo Clinic. I'm sorry, I don't have that number.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to just getting some of that, and I can look that up too. I thought I had, and I got an old document. So my apologies, committee, for grabbing an old document. So, all right. Unless there's any other questions. I thank you for your time and thank you for presenting to us. I think it's been a long time since these appropriations were discussed in committee, so I appreciate you coming forward and letting us know what you've done with those appropriations.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, next we are going to go revert back in the committee agenda and revert back to approving the minutes. So I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of February 27th. Madam Chair,
I saw that eye contact. Madam Chair, I'll move those minutes.
And I will note for the record that we do have quorum. We have, I believe, every member at the table, so we are good there. So thank you for moving the motion to approve the minutes. So Representative Scott moves the approval of the minutes from February 27th. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. All right, now on to the next agenda item. So next on the agenda, we have Representative Steer, and he will be presenting House File 541. And Representative Steer, since you're not a member of this committee, you and I serve on a different committee together, I will move the Representative Steer's House File 541 to be recommended to be referred back to the Committee on Public Safety. So the bill is before us, Representative Steer. You have an amendment.
I do.
It's an author's amendment, and it's a little bit technical. Do you want to just describe your amendment briefly, and then we'll move the amendment?
Sure. Amendment A2 provides an undesignated percentage of the appropriation to OHE that can retain for the admission and monitoring, which is in line 1.10. The 2023 House Budget Bill, House File 2890, allowed OHE to retain 2.5%, which is the amount authorized in the 2023 bill to pass the House. So that's all we're changing, is to put the 2.5 in.
Great. I will move the amendment, the A2. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Steer.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. All right, so House File 541. Chair Novotny began work on this bill about 4 years ago, meeting with law enforcement, use of force trainers, and talking with psychologists and law enforcement leaders. The goal of this bill is to provide professional police officer training for peace officers in service on the proper use of force, including deadly force, the duty to intercede, and the duty to de-escalate. House File 541 appropriates $2.5 million to the Office of Higher Education for reimbursement grants to post-secondary schools. The college must satisfy satisfactory requirements on deadly force and firearms requirements. Use scenario-based trainings that simulates real-world situation and involves the use of real firearms that fire non-lethal ammunition. including training on physical and psychological effects of stress, include training on de-escalation methods and tactics, bias motivation, defense tactics, and force-on-force training, and be offered to peace officers at no charge to the peace officer or the law enforcement agency. Colleges who that offer this training are reimbursed at a rate of $450 for each officer. During the Public Safety Committee, I did have testifiers Andrew Rooney, who is the Interim Director of Peace Officers Education at Alexandria Technical College, and Tom Draper, who is the Director, Professional Police Officers Education Coordinator, Hennepin Technical College. They both testified in, they spoke highly of the bill. So I do not have any testifiers today, but I can take any questions that you have.
Thank you, Representative Steer. Are there any members of the public that wish to testify? Okay, seeing none. And also, the jurisdiction of this committee is fairly narrow because it is being appropriated to OHE, and you did do an amendment so that they can retain 2.5% in order to cover administrative costs. If okay, we'll start with Representative Cleaveord, and then we'll go to Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering about the 2.5%. Madam Chair, I know we passed legislation last year that said 5% for non-competitives and 10% for competitive grants. And I'm wondering if 2.5% is actually sufficient for the cost of the administration of this program. And since we're looking at all grants, even though I just want to make sure that we're doing the right thing and that we have the right staff with the right eyes on the grants to make sure that they're going where they need to go. So, and then the other question I have is, I'm not opposed to the idea of the bill. The other question I would have is for you, Madam Chair, the plan for this bill is to go again where?
Thank you for asking. So it's going back to public safety.
Okay, so we'll go back to public safety. Okay, because it would be in their budget, and then they would decide where it goes after that. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, but I do need to double check with the public safety chair who's in the room.
Okay, so then my question would be, does OHE believe that 2.5% is sufficient for them to handle this grant request? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just looking around the room to see if anyone from OHE is here today, and I am not seeing. Oh, yes, we do have some. Oh, there they are. All right. If they would come to the testifier stand. Ms. Oliver, I thought so, and you just happened to be hiding behind a head. I hope nobody ever says that, Ms. Oliver. Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry. So please introduce yourself to the committee, and hopefully you heard the question, and we'll let you answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Megan Fitzgibbon, the Manager of Grants and Workforce Initiatives at the Office of Higher Education. And I would say that we do, recommend and follow and expect and hope that we can get the 5% that's in statute now for non-competitive formula funded like this type of program would be. That meets our administrative burden to do all the monitoring, the grant monitoring that would be required in this. As many of you know, there are other bills that have been introduced that would require in-person monitoring. So that means that we would have, and it's recommended, and we do that as much as we can, but we would have to travel to Alexandria, to Hennepin Tech, to all the other institutions that would provide these. As long as those grants were over $50,000, we'd have to do that monitoring visit at least once per year. And also all the other, administrative burden it is just to get the money out the door. So reviewing the reports that come in, reviewing the reimbursement requests, doing progress reporting, all of those types of things would also be required to administer a program like this.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzgibbons. I happen to know because I had Hennepin Tech in my office earlier today that now I don't know who's going to take us up on this offer of doing this training, but also Hibbing and Fond du Lac, which are even further than Hennepin Tech. So it could be some travel included. Yes, Representative Cleaver.
So to that point, I'm wondering if the author would be willing to consider an oral amendment to just have line 1.10 stop after peace officers, period, and then just allow the statutory amount to flow.
I will turn it over to Representative Steer, and if you need the public safety chair to weigh in, we can do that as well, because we happen to have him in the room. So
sure.
We are at an advantage today because we've got the right players in the room, interestingly enough, Representative Steer.
All right, so I have to admit I do not have a copy of the bill. I'm a freshman, so, you know, I'm getting used to this whole thing. So if somebody could provide that to me, that'd be great. Thank you. All right, so what am I looking at?
So if you would please go to line 1.10. And you see the very first two words are peace officers in that line. And then after peace officers, I would ask for a period to be placed there. And then the remainder of that line and line 1.11 would be removed. So it would allow the statutory 5% as non-competitive grants to go to the institutions.
And Representative
OHE.
Representative Cleburne, we're actually going to go to nonpartisan just to make
That'd
sure
be
because,
awesome. Yeah.
You know, we're pretty good at this, but,
no, I'm good.
You know,
thanks.
We're not always the best, so we're going to go to our nonpartisan, and then after that, I'm going to go to the public safety chair and have him weigh in as well. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment would be page 1, line 10, delete everything after the period. Page 1, delete line 11.
And Mr. Hopkins, what would that functionally do? Would that accomplish the concern of the 2.5% we just put in versus statutorily maybe more suggested of 5%?
So under section 16B.98, if the law doesn't specifically specify what a state agency gets for its administrative costs, they can retain up to 5% of the amount appropriated for grants to cover those administrative costs. So that default statute would apply.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. And I'm going to go to Representative Novotny, since you are right here with us, Mr. Public Safety Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. I just, maybe it'd be a good question for the person from higher ed that was just back up there on the numbers. I could just point something out about this.
Ms. Fitzgibbons is back. Go ahead and ask your question, Representative Novotny.
So I would be the first to admit that I did not do well in high school math, but I heard you testify that you'd have to make how many trips to verify this?
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, it depends on how many institutions provide it. I don't have that in front of me. How many institutions provide this training or could provide this training at some point in the future. I don't know if there's any development, if there are any private institutions that also provide it. I just know of the ones that have been mentioned, Alex Tech, Fond du Lac, Hennepin Tech. But, you know, at a minimum, as long as the grantee receives or expects to receive over $50,000 in a grant period, which is either 1 year or 2 year, depending on it, we are required to do a grant monitoring visit, which at least at this point is recommended to be in person if possible. So we would have to go to the location. We would have to perhaps observe training if it's happening at the same time. We would have to, you know, perhaps look at their books, look at their, you know, check in with their instructors. Like that's what we would normally do in a grant monitoring visit. We would have to do that at all the locations where they're getting funds, as long as their grant is $50,000 or more.
Representative Otney.
Thank you. My question would be, and if someone could double check my math here, but the grant amounts for the asked amount is $2.5 million, and if we get the full amount at 5%, would that be $125,000 to make probably 3 trips? And check the books of your organization that you already oversee would be my question.
Okay.
We need $125,000 for that.
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Yeah, Chair Representative, to administer a grant, and of course we are not over Minnesota State, so the Office of Higher Education doesn't we are not over the Minnesota State institutions. to do a formula-funded grant is essentially the same as what's required of a competitive grant without the competition. So that is one aspect, grant monitoring visits, but we also have to administer the grant, which means we have to get grant contracts, we have to negotiate grant contracts, we have to have work plans and budgets, we have to follow the law, which requires them to provide lists, I believe, of the students or the officers that have gone through training. We have to check that. We have to then get the money out the door. So our financial services staff have to go through the process of making payments through SWIFT. We have to do progress reports to see, you know, are they moving along? You know, that's a lot more to grant. Grant monitoring is one thing that would probably be one of the bigger expenses would be travel related to grant monitoring. But 120% represents one FT, essentially one program administrator, grant program administrator in our office. It's about 101 FTE without the benefits. And that's just the salary.
Representative Novotny.
Chair Eric, thank you. One last question, and what you just described, overseeing this one program, you feel is the equivalent of a full-time employee, 2,080 hours minus vacation and paid family medical leave.
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Chair, Representative, I believe that when the law was amended, when the statutes were created under Office of Grants Management did a time study with the grant programs that they run, as well as checking with other agencies, and came up with that 5% and 10% specifically using those hours, demonstrating that yes, it would to administer, it's X number of hours, and I don't have it in front of me, but it was, you know, somewhere around that where we would end up with about 5% would represent how much it would cost to administer a grant program. They did a time study to determine the number of hours that were necessary. And then, you know, that does represent one FTE, but also all the technology behind administering a program, whether we have to have SWIFT, we have to have all of our technology that we use for grant administration, have to add those programs in, have to do, you know, monitor, have to do advertising, communications with the institutions, those types of things, in addition to not just the hours necessary for an individual to do a program.
Representative Novotny.
It's been an educational experience for me, Chair Eric, so I'm going to vote against this amendment, but I feel we need to move on and get back to public safety.
Okay. All right, so your recommendation is to just not adopt. Well, I guess that would be an oral amendment, so that would be, I have a 24-hour rule, but it's a little bit more than technical, but I'm mulling it all over. I'm considering that. And was it Representative?
Chair.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Cleburne. I thought Representative Liebling had a question, too.
Mine's a separate thing.
So. Oh, okay. Perfect. Representative Cleburne, let's finish up this conversation.
Chair, the Committee of Jurisdiction is public safety. The bill, we are being told, and you promise it's going back to public safety, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Since it's not our budget, I will then...
Withdraw
that. That's no problem. But it is something that we need to be thinking about if we are really serious about reducing any kind of misuse of state funding. We need to make sure that we have the real systems in place to make sure that the grants are really going where they're supposed to go and they're really being used appropriately. And none of this is free, right? So we have to make sure that we're accounting for the real costs. Thank you.
Representative Cleburne, I appreciate that tremendously, and I really do. This was a genuine conversation in committee. It wasn't pre-planned, this is what we need to do in committee. Chair Novotny has heard all of this conversation. The author has heard all the. Oh, and we have to go back to Ms. Fitzgibbons. She has more.
Chair, Ms. Oliver reminded me that the statute allows for up to 5%. Mm-hmm. So if we determine that, you know, we had a staff person that was working on another smaller program and only needed half of their salary or 75% of their salary or whatever, we would then turn the additional funds available or make the only use what we needed, and the additional funds would then be available for grants that go out.
I did note that in the statute as well, too, that it is up to, so that does give me a little comfort. But I think we've had a really robust conversation. I don't have an amendment other than the oral amendment that you've now withdrawn. But what I'd like to do is pass it or take a vote on it as it is. We'll send it back to public safety. They can grapple with it. We have the advantage of actually having the public safety chair, and we have several members of the public safety committee here, so they have just heard this whole conversation. I agree with you that we absolutely need to have the administration covered in their costs, especially if they're going to be traveling to Hibbing and Fond du Lac or whoever decides to take this up. I appreciate that. We want that to be covered. I want that on the record that I think that we should cover those costs, and there's a reason why that's in statute. So. But for today, we've had this conversation. Unless there's any, Representative Liebling, you have a question, correct? Let's go to Representative Liebling. I like your question, so please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this has been an interesting discussion. I mean, one thing that just jumped out at me from this discussion we just had is that what the bill does is reimburses. It's not really, I don't know if it's even considered a grant because it's a reimbursement for, but anyway, so I don't know how that enters into the discussion that was just had, because it's probably a whole different or a partly different process to verify, you know, that something happens so that you can reimburse for it. So that's a different thing. But anyway, that wasn't really why I raised my hand in the first place, which was really to say that when I look at this bill, I'm not a public safety person. I do like the description of what the training is, and I do see that could be a really valuable thing. But my question is whether this is a new thing, or isn't this something that is already happening? Or to put it a different way, what is new about this program, Representative Steer, that you're proposing in this bill? Why is it necessary to come and bring a bill for a new program? Because I know that we do a lot of law enforcement training. Maybe it isn't in-service training, or anyway, shed some light if you would, please.
Representative Steer.
All right, thanks, Chair. So what this training is, it's bringing a multi-jurisdictional training together. So this is pairing up a officer in Minneapolis with an officer in Duluth and having them train together so that you understand that it's one fluid movement together. So law enforcement training, like myself, we would go to training and maybe attend with other agencies. This is more of a hands-on in-service training where you use things that we typically don't use and agencies maybe can't afford would be the less lethal firearms or the simunition rounds. So they're not actually like live ammunition. Obviously, that would be bad. But so simunition rounds, kind of putting stress on the officers, having them work together, and then you work with the duty to intercede as well. So then you have a 23-year veteran going up with a rookie and put in a position where that rookie needs to be able to intercede if that 23-year veteran is using excessive force. So it's okay to do that for the rookie to tell the veteran officer that you can't, you have to stop. So that reinforces this training. If it doesn't matter rank and file, when something bad is happening, everybody has to step in and stop it if it happens.
Representative Liebling. Well,
thank you. Thank you, Representative. I mean, that sounds great. It really does sound great. I'm just not sure, though, in terms of the bill, is this kind of, this is, the way the bill is structured, it's something to be done by organizations that are already doing, they're certified to provide programs for peace officer education. So, but is this like something that isn't already happening? There's no training of this type already? And because what you described, maybe I missed it, but I didn't sort of see that in the bill. That sounds really great. But I'm just trying to get, you know, a lot of times I've noticed in the areas that I work in that we tend to reinvent the wheel a lot because there's a program somewhere, but because I don't know about it, I want to create it. And I'm just want to know kind of, are we duplicating something? Are we adding to something?
Representative Steer.
Thank you, Chair. So what we're doing here is we're offering the training at no cost to the agency. So yes, this training does exist. It's just very costly. So you have to go to outside entities in order to get this. So there's several training groups that are out there that you can send your officers to, and it, you know, the cost can range from $1,000 to $3,000 for, you know, a 2 or 3 day training. This is for the agencies in outstate Minnesota or greater Minnesota that can't afford that training, that type of training, and then they can send their officers to, you know, Hennepin Tech or Alex, wherever they're close to. I know Hibbing's involved, so we're trying to hit as many locations across the state as we can to save on travel, to save on the hours that you're paying your officers. But this is a training that, it's a high-level training that is essentially free for the agency other than the wages that they have to pay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you. That's really helpful. Appreciate it.
Any other member, Representative Coulter? And then we'll finish up with Representative Wolgamott, unless there's, oh, and we'll go to Novotny, then Wolgamott. Any others before I?
Oh.
Okay, we're going to start with Coulter, then we'll go to Novotny, then we'll go to Wolgamott. Okay, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question that I think is probably within this committee's jurisdiction. And you said something just now that made really sort of pique my interest there. And you said this training otherwise might cost, you said $1,000 to $3,000. And then my original question was, I see that the reimbursement rate here is $450 for each officer. So I want to be clear, I'm not necessarily opposed to eating some of the costs. I mean, like Representative Liebling said, that it sounds like something that may be worth doing. I guess my question really is, how much of the costs does that reimbursement really cover, if that makes sense, to provide the training?
Representative Steer.
Thank you, Chair. So the program hasn't been designed yet, and the instructors haven't been picked. But I do believe that when the post-secondary colleges come around and knocking on doors asking for some of the high-level training, and they say that, you know, we're going to offer this to Greater Minnesota, and we're going to pair it up with, cities like Edina and Eden Prairie, I do think we're going to get some high-level instructors here that maybe we'll do it at a reduced fee. I can't say that for certain, but building the program itself, once approved, will take time and effort from the higher education system to find the best instructors we can possibly find. Because in law enforcement, if you attend a training and you don't like it or it's not worth the money, the cops talk and it doesn't ever work. But if you provide high level training for officers and they enjoy it, it'll spread and everybody's gonna wanna go to it.
Representative Coulter.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would just, you know, this isn't coming out of our budget, so it's to a certain extent maybe kind of not worth too much time, but I do, you know, just want to be very careful that when we're saying that these post-secondary institutions are providing this, that, you know, the costs are being talked about so that we're not putting some costs on schools that are already strapped for cash a bit. That's all. Thank you.
Representative Coulter, I appreciate that sentiment. We'll go to Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Rarick, and I can answer many of your questions, and I thank Representative Steer for presenting this bill for me. But to answer your questions, first of all, Representative Coulter, this is the number that we went to the schools when this 2021 we first started working on this. We went to the schools, made the proposal to them what we wanted to do, and they came up with the number. And we have adjusted that up. They do have the outline. Everything's laid out what they want to do. We wanted to use the Alex Tech and Hennepin Tech, the ones that are already doing the skills programs right now, because they have the, whatever you want to call them, the instructors or the actors that have the ability to create that high stress. And that's what we're looking for, the high quality training that, as Representative Steer was talking about, most departments do their use of force training in-house. You're doing it with the same guy that you work with, the same guy that you or gal that you, you know, go on calls with. You're doing this all together. Former Chair Mariani was working with me on this bill, and he made two of the suggestions that we included. Section three on the post-traumatic stress, thinking that this would be a good time when you've got people at that high, once, you know, with the simulations, we've got the ability to get your stress up, get that adrenaline running. That's a great time to then talk about how to deal with that stress with the additional advantage of your off-site. You're not talking to your sergeant, who might also be your firearms instructor, who almost, you know, who could be your supervisor and doing your eval. If you've got a problem, this would be a chance to talk to somebody that's outside of your normal comfort zone. And then Chair Mariani also requested Section 4 about the bias training. So he put that in, and we worked with him on that. That's how long we've been working on this bill to try to get through. It did pass in 23 off the floor. Didn't go anywhere. It got dropped in conference committees. think have answered all the questions that came up, but that's where we're at. And it is, like you said, this is training that was inspired after looking in the events that happened in Minneapolis with George Floyd about, as Representative Steer talked about, you've got that situation where you need to step up and do this duty. You know, you've got to step in. You got to do what's right. It doesn't matter who the other people are there or what's going on. And my inspiration was the last high-speed chase I had before I retired was a armed robbery with a stolen vehicle. And it went through 5 or 6 different counties, untold jurisdictions, through everywhere, ended up in somewhere up in Morrison County on a dirt road that I couldn't find again if I had to when the suspect hit a deer and it disabled his car. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, at the end, there was so many jurisdictions there, I couldn't tell you who was there. If someone at the end of a 20-mile chase with their adrenaline at a scale they haven't had in a long time, hasn't got the ability to handle themselves, if they haven't been in that situation, there's only one way we're going to be able to replicate the multi-jurisdictional training, and this is what we've come up with.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Okay, I'm going to go to, unless there's any other member questions, we'll go to Representative Lead Wolgamont.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to take a moment to express my support for this legislation. As we know, I'm a designated non-voting member of this committee, so I won't be able to express that with my vote, but I do want to thank Representative Steer for bringing this bill forward. I want to thank Chair Novotny for his thoughtful work on this legislation over the years. There's no question that by passing this bill, providing this funding, empowering our officers with this critical training, the use of force training, and that experience is going to lead to enhanced public safety in the state of Minnesota. It will protect our officers. It will protect members of the public. And I'm not on the Public Safety Committee, but I really hope that Chair Novotny, you and other members are able to find the funding for this. We can get this over the finish line and improve public safety in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Wolgamont. Unless there's any other conversation, we're going to go to the motion to re-refer. So I'd like to renew my motion that House File 541 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Pardon me? Oh, as amended. I'll change my motion. I'll renew my motion that House File 41 be recommended to be re-referred. As amended. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's try that again. I will try it for the third time. I renew my motion that House File 541, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. There, now we have the right motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and your bill is on its way back to public safety. Thank you, Representative Steer. Great presentation. Thank you. Okay, next up on our agenda, we have Cook County Higher Education Board. Welcome. I'm very excited to have them come before us today. They have come a very far way. Before you get settled in, I think it's a 6-hour drive down?
Yep, about 5.5.
5.5, oh my. Well, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you.
As you're getting settled in, please introduce yourself to the committee and go ahead with your presentation. And I believe we have Representative Scraba that will start us off with some remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm happy to be here today to talk about Cook County Higher Education. It's an organization that provides access to education and residents and businesses in Cook County. Cook County, the Cook County Higher Education is located in Grand Marais, which is the tip of northern Minnesota, way up there, where everyone goes up to vacation. There's 5,500 people that live there. And they've created this one-stop shop for residents and businesses that need access to education while living and working in Cook County. I appreciate your support of this organization in my district. It serves a cost-effective way to match up with higher education and college needs of residents to existing MNSCU long-distance programs, brings workforce training to businesses and employees of Cook County, and partners with organizations throughout the county to support their missions through training opportunities. I was going to keep reading. Let me finish this, and then I'm going to let, because these guys are the experts at this. But the people of Cook County are proud of Cook County Higher Ed. Do they have the copy of everything?
Yep. Representative Scraba, we have their 990. So there are 3 years' worth of 990s that are on the website, on the committee page. But we have the most recent 990. We have their audited financial statements in our packets. And I believe we also have a spreadsheet here that is kind of a high level, which is fantastic. So it's basically our government sources and our non-government sources, and it's fantastic. So I appreciate all of that work, yes.
I'm wondering, did you guys get the letters of support from the small businesses?
Representative okay. Scraba, we also have an entire folder full.
I encourage you.
An entire folder full of recommendations and letters and support.
And there's only 5,500 people, Chair, and, you know, you got most of them there, you know. but
Representative Scraba, we greatly appreciate that they've come down for 5.5 hours to talk about their wonderful nonprofit. And so we are very excited to hear from them today. Thank you.
Yep.
So let's turn it over to Ms. Blackburn, if you would introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you very much, Representative Scraba. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Karen Blackburn. I am the Executive Director of Cook County Higher Education, and thank you for inviting me here to introduce my organization. With me is Kelsey Rogers Kennedy. She's the Associate and the Program Director, and you will also hear from Rob Wells, a former student, via Zoom. I'd like to start today with a video presentation that provides you with insight into who we are, what we do, and who we serve. I also hope when I am finished that you will understand the impact that we have on our community, why what we do is important, and why we are funded through the higher education budget. Please note in the video that we are sometimes referred to as CCHE or higher ed. Cook County Higher Education provides so much to the community through every type of education that anybody would ever want. We are the go-to resource for education outside of K through 12 in this community. If anybody wants to go to school or continue their education, whether it be through a certificate, to start a new job, get their master's or their doctorate, or they want to go and get their associate's degree for the first time to learn a new skill or try a new career, then we are the people that can help them. All of those people are helped daily by us.
Yeah, my name is Chris Skildum. I'm owner of Skildum & Company, LLC. We're a contracting firm. We do residential and commercial construction. Part of being a licensed contractor is maintaining continuing education for the DLI, and I've gone to a handful of contractor workshops that meet that DLI criteria for continuing ed. At least 3 or 4 classes related to payroll and bookkeeping, the new sick and safe time laws, MSHA mining safety class, put several of the guys through that, log safe class, chainsaw felling. Cook County Higher Education has provided is invaluable because of where we live. To get all of those classes, I would otherwise have to drive a minimum of 2 hours to Duluth or further.
Grand Marais is located about 50 miles from the Canadian border on the shores of Lake Superior. There's one road in and one road out. Duluth is 110 miles away. If we want to do anything that isn't located here, we have to go all the way to Duluth to take care of business like that, and that includes going to school.
Hello, my name is Sarah. My family and I have the Java Moose here in Grand Marais, Minnesota. We have had a very long-standing relationship with higher ed. They help us with our food service certification. In order to have a food establishment, you have to be trained and certified in food safety.
as an employer of truck drivers in the county, the CDL program has actually increased the pool of applicants who are applying to our jobs. The last two hires that we had are both CDL graduates. Without Cook County Higher Ed's CDL program, we would be short drivers. There's plenty of snow this year, and it would definitely be an issue for us if we didn't have a full staff. In addition to the CDL program, every 2 years we need to train all of our employees for first aid. It's one call to Cook County Higher Ed, and we figure it out and then get everybody trained. My name is Matt Nesheim. I'm the maintenance superintendent of the Cook County Highway Department, and I'm a big advocate for the Cook County Higher Education.
CCHE also provides wraparound services like free tutoring, quiet study spaces, and exam proctoring to ensure that learners of all ages have the support they need to take the next step in their education and career.
Okay, so when I started, I didn't know how to start anyway. And I work at the Southwest Mountain Clinic as a clinical assistant then, and I wanted to pursue nursing.
And so having someone here that can sit down with you side by side and open up your program on the laptop or on the computer, show you how to move through that, and show you how to take an exam or use the online system, that's really important.
Which I had no idea at first. And since then, that was like the very beginning.
And because we know each other and we are such a small community, it's less intimidating and it feels more comfortable for people.
She helped me look for a school that can accommodate my needs. She helped me with admission at first and also like the whole process.
We have a person here who can help you make those phone calls, stay on the phone with you, make sure that your problems are resolved. And we do that every day.
You know, as a student support coordinator, she really helped me all the way through from the beginning to until I graduated.
Her entire job is to make sure that people have access to long-distance education and are successful in their everyday tasks.
Right now, I'm working as a licensed practical nurse at the Southwest Mountain Clinic, and I am proudly saying that I am helping the community, which is my number one goal ever since I started. And this, you know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the Cook County Higher Ed.
When people have the support they need to learn and grow, the entire community thrives. CCHE's impact is rooted in education, expanding access to learning, training, and growth. This work not only empowers individuals, but also fuels opportunity, strengthens our local economy, and enriches the lives of everyone who lives, works, and visits here. CCHE supports learning at every stage of life, helping individuals and the community thrive.
Thank you. Ms. Blackburn.
That's a good overview of what we do, and I'd like to give you a little more detail. I'm going to read my testimony because we do so much, and I just don't want to miss out on anything. We are located, we showed you, in the far northeast corner of the state in Grand Marais. Oh, the slides are in your folder if you'd like to follow along. The closest MNSCU institution or any higher education facility is in Duluth, which is 2 to 3 hour drive. We came about because in the early 1990s, the community recognized the need for higher education options for Cook County residents, and we researched the idea of creating a community college. When it was determined that a brick and mortar institution could not be supported, the idea of an organization to help students enroll in long distance education resulted in the creation of Cook County Higher Education, and that was 28 years ago. We have a mighty staff of 4 people, and we have 10 board members. And the board is all volunteer, and all of the board members live in Cook County. Over the years, CCHE offerings have evolved to meet the needs of the community. Currently, we support 3 primary functions: long-distance college education, workforce and trades training, and lifelong learning. Our flagship enterprise is long-distance college education. We have been supporting students for decades, and we know what we are doing. As you saw in the video, we have a staff person whose only job is to figure out the best way to achieve a person's educational goal and help them attain it. Each person who walks in the door has a distinct set of circumstances. It is our job to chat with the potential students to learn about their interests, what their needs are, and any potential roadblocks they have. Then, often after hours of research, we help them create a plan that meets their unique situation. And that's just the beginning. Next is completing the FAFSA, applying to the school, and enrolling. Once they are enrolled, we help navigate the school's online system, proctor tests, and advocate when needed. As we report each year to MNSCU, the tuition generated from the local student enrollment is consistently over our $300,000 allocation from the budget. Okay, next slide, please. Oh, next one. I skipped one, sorry. For those in the room that appreciate quantitative data, these are some of the numbers we reported to MNSCU for fiscal year 24. We generated $411,345 in tuition payments for students enrolled in 1,512 credits. We have supported these students with 458 hours of research and advocacy and 514 one-on-one student meetings. On a more qualitative note, let me tell you about a man recovering from addiction. With the help of CCHE, he was able to do what no one else in his family had done, enroll in and complete an AA degree. He completed his internship in Grand Marais and is now working in Grand Portage as a probation officer. And he is just one person. CCHE does this work every day. We know the people, we help them, and then they in turn positively contribute to the fabric of our community. Although it has always been an option for students, in the past decade or so, CCHE has started to offer more workforce and trades training opportunities. We are very well known by businesses in the community as the go-to for providing training their employees need. Last year, we provided 245 workforce and professional development workshops, and we had over 3,000 attendees, and 72 CEUs were earned. Next one. These are some of the trainings we offered. You heard about the commercial driver's license training in the video. We were able to bring that in-person training to Cook County through the customized training solutions arm of Minnesota North College. With the support of Chair DeShaw of the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, we secured some federal and IRRR funding over the last 3 years to offer this certificate program free to over 80 residents. Minnesota North received the tuition for all of them. Our local solid waste company, the Cook County Highway Department, the local trucking company, our school district, Arrowhead Transportation, and others benefited from the new CDLA, B, and bus drivers. We provide training in Cook County so employees do not have to drive to Duluth or Minneapolis. And if you get a chance to read the letters of support, you will find over and over again how CCHE's trainings are essential to our community. If we didn't exist, there is no other place in Cook County that will offer these trainings. We have a good model, and it works. And as you can see from this list, we span pretty much every industry, from surf safe to chainsaw safety, entrepreneurial support to welding. We offer classes for annual renewals like CE credits for building contractors, OSHA training, and CPR certifications. And we create life-changing classes like how to start a small business and the commercial driver's license classes. All of these trainings are open to the public. We bring our customized training to the businesses all over the county so it is convenient for employers and employees. Some of you know what it is like to live in a small town. We interact with our students every day. Kelsey has a 7-year-old whose bus driver graduated from the CDL program. When we eat out, we know the kitchen staff went through ServSafe training. If we are unfortunate enough to have an EMT come to our home, we might have celebrated with them when they passed their certification exam in our facility. Jackie May from the video was my nurse at my last visit to the clinic. Our work impacts our community. Last arm of what we do. Our third category of education is lifelong learning. We listen to our community by attending meetings, soliciting feedback, and honestly having conversations in the grocery store. We create in-person and hybrid events for our residents. Some examples are listed here. What is AI? And how do you use Google Apps? Parenting support, language classes, and navigating the challenges that come with aging. Because Grand Portage is located in Cook County, Indigenous history classes help us learn from each other. We record many of our events so residents can access them anytime and from anywhere. These lifelong learning events contribute to the well-being of community members. They foster an environment where individuals can grow professionally and personally, and in turn, this creates a more vibrant, thriving community where everyone has the opportunity to learn, create connections, and improve their quality of life. When I was contacted about coming here today to tell you about who we are, what we do, and who we serve, I was also asked to list all of the revenue sources for the last 3 years. This slide is difficult to read, so I've included the one-page blow-up of it. As you can see, our revenue comes from the higher ed budget and from local and regional grant sources. We are supported and appreciated by our community and our regional grantors who know that they can count on us to provide the education and training they need, and they stand behind that belief through donations and grants. So if you see almost to the bottom, you can see the grants that we receive are in the middle of the page, and lower down it's donations. It's this donation number that comes directly from our members, like our individual people and our community businesses every year. Those banners that were on the side of our building are people that have made significant contributions to us, and we like to tell people about it. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. I have listed the letters of support in your folder here by industry. I've asked for these letters of support last Monday, and by Thursday, I had 18 in my hand. If you find time to read them, you will find that most list specific ways that we have helped their organization, and some have really compelling personal stories. In one letter, you will read how Cook County welcomes 1.5 million visitors each year and the importance of ServSafe, EMT, and CPR training. The Small Business Development Center letter highlights how we support new small businesses, provide classes for all populations, and support post-secondary education, just like what might happen in the Twin Cities. We feel very important with that. In all of the letters that you will hear that we are creative, efficient, forward-thinking, and empowering. We reduce barriers to education, and we are indispensable. Finally, I leave you with this quote from a student who went back to school to finish her bachelor's degree. She said, "I did graduate last month. It was so awesome. Thank you for all you and CCHE did to bring me along the way. I couldn't have done it without you, especially at the beginning. It had been 20 years since I went to school and felt super overwhelmed with everything. Thank you so much." Now, one more part of the presentation before we have questions. I'd like to introduce you to a former student that used our services to change his career and his life path. His name is Rob Wells.
Welcome, Mr. Wells. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Rob Wells. Is my microphone working?
Your microphone is working.
Great. All right. Well, thank you all for allowing me time to speak of my experience with Cook County Higher Education. As I just said, my name is Rob Wells. I currently work as a registered nurse and paramedic at North Shore Health in Grand Marais. A couple things about North Shore Health. It's a critical access hospital. We have 16 rooms and 4 beds in our ER. We're the most remote critical access hospital in the state and one of the most remote in the lower 48. My wife and I moved to Grand Marais almost 20 years ago. We raised 2 children here. My eldest is a sophomore at St. Olaf in Northfield, Umiaya, and my youngest is a junior at the high school here locally. My wife's family also lives in Grand Marais. So we originally moved to Cook County when I took a position as the executive chef at Lutzen Resort, a position that I held for 10 and a half years. And when I left in 2016, I was pretty ready for a career change. I had done pretty much everything that I had wanted to do as a chef in my life and was looking for new challenges. By that time, I'd been a volunteer firefighter here in Grand Marais for about 4 years, and I'd been an emergency medical responder with them throughout that time as well. And responding to neighbors' houses in the middle of the night, helping them with their emergencies, getting them to the hospital was something that I found really rewarding. But there are a lot of barriers to thinking about quitting your job and starting school full-time to go do something like a nursing degree. especially when you're a father of two kids. You live in Grand Marais, where the travel times to the next closest college is 2 hours or more. School's expensive. It gets more expensive every year. And that's where Cook County Higher Education came in. And the support that I received from Cook County Higher Education was critical in my transition into nursing. They were able to help provide training, support, scholarships, test proctoring. The laptop that I'm speaking to you over Zoom right now is one that I got as part of a grant through higher ed for my school. And the ability to do classwork remotely with internet access was another thing that early on, before we had widespread high-speed internet in the county, we frequently did at higher ed using their internet access. So these are things that higher ed's helped me all throughout. In 2018, I graduated from Lake Superior College in Duluth with my associate's degree, go ITOCs. And then in 2022, I graduated from Mankato State University with my bachelor's degree. And none of that would have been possible without the support that I got from higher ed. A few years after I became a nurse, Kelsey, the program director at PCAT, reached out to me about the possibility of doing American Red Cross teaching for CPR and first aid. They were looking to grow that program and thought that I would be a good fit for it. So I went on to complete the necessary training to become an instructor. Today, CCHE organizes and hosts American Red Cross adult and pediatric CPR, AED, and first aid training. And I teach these classes for the public once a month. We also started teaching naloxone training through higher ed as a partnership with Public Health and Human Services. And that's to help address the opioid crisis here in the Northland, teaching people to be able to administer naloxone for people who've overdosed. In addition, I travel to businesses, schools, daycares, and other organizations to provide customized group training sessions organized by Cook County Higher Education and bring life-saving skills to the locations throughout the county. Living and working in a small rural community has made my role as a nurse even more personal. In the ER, on the ambulance, and in the hospital, I often find myself caring for people I know, whether it's a child who's come down with a fever after clinic hours, a community member experiencing a heart attack, or someone I've known for years in a car accident. I've also been there for families during heartbreaking moments like sudden loss of a loved one or when someone's facing a mental health crisis. These experiences make the work I do feel even more meaningful. It's humbling to be part of their care during these times, and it adds a deeper layer of meaning for what I do. The same sense of connection that contributes to my work as a nurse also drives my teaching through higher ed. Bystander CPR and first aid is crucial in the chain of survival, even more so in a rural area like Cook County, where an ambulance may be anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour or more away. The people I train live and work around me. I know that the skills I'm sharing could one day save a life, whether it's mine, my family's, or a neighbor's. Bystander CPR and first aid is crucial. Teaching these classes is about more than just passing on knowledge. It's about creating lasting change. Being part of CCHE has changed my life from becoming a nurse to now teaching life-saving skills to others. This training is spreading throughout our community. Every time I think that we have trained anyone that needs it, we have another group sign up. As Kelsey often says during the welcome at the start of each training, when she thanks everybody for attending, quote, by being here, you're making our community safer for us, our families, and all those who live and visit around here, end quote. The impact is real, and it's something that continues to grow.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I know they've come a very long way, so I'm going to let Representative Novotny ask a question. And we do have another presentation after this we'd like to get to. Representative Novotny.
I can be very brief. I've been married happily almost 30 years, and I say that to mean that when I'm wrong, I can admit I was wrong. When we were doing our deep dive into the budget earlier, we had seen this line item, and I was skeptical. I went to your website. I was like, what is this Cook County Higher Ed? Uh-huh. I read Representative Scraba's bill and talked to him briefly about what was going on, and he started to point out what you guys actually do, which is really hard to comprehend without knowing. Met with your lobbyist. What really turned me around was seeing your financials and seeing how you're doing and your fundraising yourself and providing you services. My wife is HR director at a nursing home, and she uses these services all the time for the nursing assistants and the getting the vital training for the first responders. I was wrong. You're a great program, and I think it's money well spent. Thank you, Representative Scraba, for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Yeah, so just a reminder for the committee, this is in a line item appropriation that was in Chapter 41 of $300,000 per year, so $600,000 in the biennium. And now you heard how much they do with four people in a very rural setting, meeting the needs of the local community. And, you know, I think you have this spreadsheet in front of you, which kind of makes it a quick snapshot for us to see the financials, which I thought was very good. You've got the 300. So if you look at fiscal year 24, 300,000 from the state here through this budget, and then they've got a few other things that are government sources. But then if you look at all of their non-government sources, it's pretty broad. You have quite a bit of support in the local community, including a lot of donations. So it's just interesting to see that and what you've been able to do with just literally four staff. So any other questions from the committee at this point? We do have another presentation after. Yes, Representative Cleburne.
I just want to wish you safe travels back.
Thank
I know
you.
It's a long way to go and the weather could be dicey. So thank you for the great work that you do, and I wish you safe travels home.
Thank you very much.
Said Representative Cleburne, we really do appreciate that you've come 5.5 hours down. I wanted to give you as much time as I possibly could because it's a long drive and you do really, really good work. Your financials look fantastic, and I've presented that to the committee. They have your most recent 990, your audited financials, your kind of snapshot, which I appreciate, and apparently 18 letters of endorsement in a matter of a few days. So that is also impressive. That shows the community buy-in and the community support, which we really appreciate. So, again, thank you so much for coming down all that way, and very impactful to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Scraba. Good stuff. Okay, so the last presentation on the agenda is the United Family Medicine Residency Program. So if they would come forward. And we do have a packet another packet. We've got a lot of paper today, members. They have their slide presentation printed out as well. So as they're getting settled in, I'll just note for the committee that this is from Chapter 41. It was just a tiny bit over $1 million appropriation in the biennium. Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your slide presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to present to you about the United Family Medicine Residency Program. My name is Dr. Badrinath Koneti, and I'm the Chief Academic Officer for Allina Health, and I oversee the undergraduate and graduate medical education programs. I have here with me Dr. Ravi Balasubramanian. He's the Interim Program Director for the United Family Medicine Residency Program, and also Dr. Robert Miner, who's the Designated Institutional Official for all GME programs within Allina Health.
Wonderful. Welcome, and continue with your presentation.
Firstly, I'd like to thank the committee, the state, and actually the citizens of the state of Minnesota for providing us the vital funding for this program, which has been going on for a long time. The program that we're talking about, the United Family Medicine Residency Program, has been around since 1993 or so, a little over 32 years or so. And we have a rich history serving the community of the 7th West District in St. Paul, as well as the state of Minnesota, because many of our graduates go and populate different practices and hospitals around the state. And we're really focused on developing people who serve the underserved, the uninsured, underinsured communities in our state, whether they're rural or urban. And the partnership with Allina Health is really helpful because it brings to play the vast resources of a health system, the widespread clinics and the hospitals that we have where our graduates can train and get a variety of different experiences. One example is that they get to train at the Mother Baby Center with the Children's Hospital in St. Paul with the Level 3 NICU, where they learn really cutting-edge techniques in maternal-fetal medicine. They train with many of our specialists and learn some of the cutting-edge techniques, whether it's specialty care like GI, for example, or cancer care. But they also get to rotate to our rural hospitals in Faribault and other places where they really get a taste for rural medicine and subsequently go and pursue a career in those locations. And our program has been receiving state funding through the higher education budget since 2012. And through this funding, we've been able to fund 21 trainees every year. And the goal for this funding, as provided to us when we originally got it, was to train about 21 residents a year. And they wanted us to prepare doctors who could practice family medicine, particularly in rural communities and in underserved areas. And we also wanted to train people who would provide accessible and affordable care to our communities. And the other thing we also do is help train the next generation of trainees, because we need residency programs to instruct medical students, without which education we can't create a pipeline of doctors for our state. And we're providing that assistance both to students from the university here as well as other neighboring states where we have residents of our state training in those medical schools. I'll now ask Dr. Balasubramanian to give you a little more detail about our program itself.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your slide presentation.
My name is Dr. Ravi Balasubramanian. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to speak to you today. I currently serve as the interim program director for the family medicine residency. Our residency is accredited through the ACGME, the body that accredits all residencies. We have 21 residents over 3 years, so it's a 777 program. About 10 years ago, we were a 666 program, but at the behest of the legislature, we expanded to 777 to meet the workforce needs of the state, both rural and urban. Each year, United Family Medicine Residency Program receives about 250 applications for our program. This last year, we had 268, 91 who actually interviewed, and we have 7 openings, which we'll be finding out who those people are in about 2 weeks. United Family Medicine Residency has become a nationally recognized program that attracts highly gifted and passionate residents who want to grow in their abilities to care for the underserved, both rural and urban. This is a map of where our residents have started practices. Each year, we send graduates to locations in the Twin Cities, metro, and rural communities. On the screen is a map of the graduates currently practicing in locations throughout Minnesota. We're proud that the graduates of our program currently practice from Duluth to Owatonna to Little Falls to Hastings. It's kind of interesting being in between Mayo, the giant program, and Little Cook County, where and some of our residents have actually rotated through that the small critical access hospital. So we're kind of in the middle. We're training the family physicians, primary care people for the future, and hopefully we'll be able to affect, like, I was very impressed with what the Cook County people actually had to say. I have to tip my hat to them. Just a brief look at what a residency is like for those who don't know. The first year, a family medicine resident spends most of their time in the hospital. They start building their own patient panel, which grows in the second year, and then by the time they've completed their residency, they have a panel of 200 to 250 patients, but there's families involved and there's many others that they actually have touched. And it's very gratifying to watch the growth in the residents and also the connection that they make within 3 years. And I think I'll turn over the financial elements to Dr. Miner.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Miner. I'm the designated institutional official for Alina, and most people don't know what a DIO is, but it's my job per the ACGME to supervise all training throughout our system, both residents and fellows, and ensure that they have the resources that they need, including pay, benefits, vacation time, et cetera, and then ensure that the programs are adhering to ACGME requirements. And I'll just profess that my background is not in finance, it's medicine, but in my role, I do work closely with our finance and reimbursement department, trying to determine the right number of trainees that come through our system. We do have a slide here for you that outlines the overview of our funding from various sources for the United program. And as you can see, like most programs, the largest source is the direct funding that comes from the federal government through CMS, and that's 48%. The state has, as you may know, the Merck program that provides supplemental funding to training programs and the medical school. And that's about 35% of our funding from that source. And then the state funding through this grant is 17%. And if there's more detailed information that you like, our team can certainly provide that. I don't know if you have some of that already.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Are there any member questions? We have about 3 minutes, and then we have a hard stop. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate the practice of family medicine. I think it's the most compassionate and close to the individual, right? So many specialties, you go in, you go out, but it's the family practice physician who really gets to know the individual. I'm concerned about this 48%, which is not really in our jurisdiction, but are you concerned about ongoing funding for this program as we are uncertain about what's happening at the very top of medical school funding and services?
Dr. Miner?
We certainly are concerned, especially at the national funding and the GME programs from CMS. We're not sure what's going to happen to that. And just to clarify as well, all these sources of funding still does not cover the entire program costs. We still have at least a $500,000 shortfall direct program funding itself. Faculty funding and resident salary funding takes up at least $3 million, of which we have total funding for about $2.5 million. So if we lose further funding, then that'll further jeopardize our ability to sustain the program.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And could you please tell me, for these family physicians, right, there are fewer and fewer programs which are providing family physicians. How many more do we have in our state in addition? I mean, we heard a little bit earlier.
Yeah, the Twin Cities is one of the three areas in the whole country where family medicine residencies really thrive. There's six in the cities, St. Cloud, Mankato, Duluth. There's also talk of, a new medical school starting, much uncertainty all over. But Minnesota is actually amongst the other states is as well endowed as it is, yet there's obviously a deficit, and then there's this huge bulge of doctors that are going to be retiring. And what are we going to do about that? And in the rural areas especially is a question that, we're all going to have to confront.
This is my last.
Yeah, Representative Cleburne, you are fine. We have about 1.5 minutes.
I did a legislative task force on aging these past 2 years, and the concern for physicians in greater Minnesota and the ability for older Minnesotans to be seen by a doctor. Do you think that the practice of family medicine is going to shift to, the distances are getting so great. How do you see that playing out, or do you have...
Doctor?
Well, the aging population, of course. There's so many elements to that. In family medicine, we do see the span all the way from, we talk about cradle to grave. And geriatrics is a large part of our practice and most of the family medicine residencies as well. Several of our grads have actually gone on and done a geriatric fellowship in addition. But you get that training in family medicine just by the demographics, both in the cities and certainly when people move out into the rural areas. So that I do, I'm of course going to be a person like yourself who's a big advocate for family medicine, but I do think that training prepares you to take care of both the aged as well as other underserved communities.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the work you do.
Thank you so much for your presentation today. We are out of time, unfortunately, and I have another committee coming in on top of us. But thank you so much for coming and presenting. It was It was very good. It was exactly what we needed. So thank you so much.
Having never been to any of these, it was actually quite interesting from the other side. And
very good.
And again, I have to say that Cook County was very